Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Good evening and happy Shabbat to one and all. My pleasure to be with you here on Yada Yah Radio. Hello, JB. Hello, Kirk.
How you doing?
How's it going?
It's good. I want to address a couple of things, maybe three, before we turn back to our analysis of the history of errant Bible translations. The first of those is what took place 6 days ago in my hometown in Charlottesville, Virginia. Unless you've been living under a rock, you know that in Charlottesville, some neo-Nazis, KKK types, and some under the label of the alt-right, descended on the city because they were incensed that American history was being rewritten, much of it being denied, and that parks named after, the case of Virginia, probably the most famous Virginian after Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, would be either Madison or Robert E. Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And a statue to Robert E. Lee was scheduled to be removed from a tiny little park at the edge of the old town of Charlottesville. Charlottesville itself didn't engage in the war, although it was used as a stopping over place to bring foodstuffs that were grown in the Shenandoah Valley into Richmond. It signed a deal with, of all people, General Custer. And Custer promised that the city would not be destroyed because they laid down their arms. So it wasn't actually engaged in the fighting itself. It has an interesting history on the previous war, in that the farm that I own there was used to ensure the Hessians, which were the German mercenaries who fought on behalf of the British during the Revolutionary War. But what the world seems to want to acknowledge is the idea that racists, neo-Nazis, and the KKK haters descended on Charlottesville because they hate. And that they were opposed by lovers, by charming people who have character and who took a moral stand to peacefully demonstrate their love for everyone except those who they hate. That's the way it's been pictured, hasn't it?
Very much.
The President of the United States, who I do not respect, actually hinted at something, not once but twice, that showed that at least someone appeared to understand what was taking place there. He said on many sides in his first speech that there was evil on many sides, and then he said both sides in a clarification later on. I will tell you that his speech on Saturday, after the violence had erupted, was amongst the most pathetic diatribes I've ever heard a leading politician utter. He is wholly unqualified for that office. I know a lot about what happened in Charlottesville. I live there. I know the history of the statue in the park, which was renamed Emancipation Park, and of the crusade of a black Charlottesville board member who has sought to have it removed. And I know of Spencer, the alt-right leader, who doesn't like history being revised. As a matter of fact, the declaration of those who want the statue removed is they want it replaced by a revised history in their own language, their own parlance. Those who want it removed want to sequester free speech. They're not advocates of free speech. They want it sequestered. They're the same people who will condemn you if you talk about homosexuality, as I do. I say, I don't care if somebody's a homosexual. I have many homosexuals who are friends. I have hired many homosexuals. I have no concern as to what somebody chooses to do in their own home and in their own lives. What I dislike is the promoting of homosexuality as if it, A, is normal, and B, honorable and good. But if I were to say that, I will have people in my face calling me a homophobe and saying I don't have the right to say those things. If I tell you that I am opposed to Black Lives Matter because it is a wholly misguided and hypocritical organization, I'll be labeled a racist, even though my opposition to it is the reality that on any given day, two African Americans are killed in the city of Chicago by fellow African Americans. Homicides average two per night in the city, 365 days a year. And that the Justice Department published statistics show that eight times out of nine, if a black man is killed, he's not killed by a white. He's killed by a fellow black man. And that there is an interracial crime that leads to one of two parties being killed eight times out of nine. The perpetrator is black and the victim is white. Black Lives Matter has it all wrong. The issue in Charlottesville is that some of the most repulsive people on the planet, neo-Nazis, the KKK, and those who are enveloped in anti-Semitic and anti-government conspiracies, the alt-right, the ilk that permeated Unpopular Truth, the kind of people now that are amplifying the anti-Semitic rage of Fritzschnell. Those individuals were baited. They are sick. They are depraved. They're irrational. Their hatred based on race, their love of Hitler and Nazism is extraordinarily repulsive, but they were played for fools. They were not the ones who came to Charlottesville to hurt, to kill. They did not strike the first blow. They were baited there by an organization called Antifa. I've spoken of them once before. I think they are the single most dangerous organization on the planet today. They emanated out of Nazi Germany. They were the communists who were opposed to the fascists. They were Machiavellian. The ends justify the means. They're anarchists. They're anti-capitalists. In America, Antifa was the group that right after that Donald Trump was elected, took to the streets by the tens of thousands in cities across America in violent, destructive, looting protests to show their rage against Donald Trump. Their banners read, "No KKK, no fascist America, no Trump." Not necessarily in that order. They're an anti-capitalist, anti-fascist organization. They only are anti-racist in the sense that their opponent, the neo-Nazis, are racist, so to oppose them, they oppose everything that they stand for. But they're violent. They openly promote violence. They're anarchists. They're really no different whatsoever than the Bolsheviks, who through anarchy and violent protests took over Russia, or Mao, and the communists with him that were so vicious in China. They are so dangerous that between Russia and China, nearly 100 million people lost their lives under the control of these communists. And yet, the media will have nothing to say of them. Once in a while, you will see them mentioned deep in an article. But the first blow was thrown by Antifa. And yet, when somebody says there were two sides, both hateful, both violent in Charlottesville, both disgusting in Charlottesville. One is swept to the side as being ignorant and out of touch with reality. You're condemned by both Republican political leaders and Democrat political leaders and political leaders around the world. Why is that? That the United States of America, the truth no longer matters. That you can't tell people the truth. That it is only correct to lie.
Is it because there's no free press? They're basically owned by private companies?
Yeah, that's part of it.
Control the information flow, you control whatever.
And it's part of it that the national moral code for America is now political correctness.
Right.
And that in socialist secular humanism, the far left is embraced.
Mm-hmm.
And that in this town in particular, in Charlottesville, Virginia, where you have the University of Virginia, this is the place where they had the march not too many years ago, where they marched and said, "We're intolerant of intolerance." I said, here is one of America, I think it's America's number one public institution. Highest rated public college in America. And the students there were chanting, "We're intolerant of intolerance." And now they hate hate. And they can't figure it out. The only difference between...
You know what I hate is stupidity.
Yeah, and they are stupid. I mean, they're absolutely hypocritical and irrational. I mean, the only difference in the two is that the neo-Nazis are few in number and they carry really big torches. And the socialist secular humanists are many in number, and they carry little candles. Really the only difference between the two. But the problem is that while very few people are neo-Nazis and part of the KKK, it's less than 1/100th of 1% of Americans, and they are universally denounced by every sane individual in the country, in the world. Everybody knows they're idiots. Everybody knows they're violent. Everybody knows they're wrong. And that's partly is why they're so few in number. They're comprised of nothing but losers. But Antifa is not few in number. There are many. People do not know they're wrong. They don't even know who they are. They are now comprised of a melding together of some of the most erroneous groups to ever be. The Occupy group that wanted to say that the whole problem of the world is that 1% have all the wealth, and if you take confiscate what the 1% have, the 99% would somehow be better off. That it was okay to steal from the 1% and give what they have to the 99%, as if that would make the world better. They're comprised of Black Lives Matter, which is now nothing but an extraordinarily liberal political group. They are comprised of CARE and pro-Islamic, anti-Israel groups. They are the Bernieites who in universities and young people across the country voted overwhelmingly for the first communist major party leader. It's frightening because there are so many of them, and they're so unthinking, they're so indoctrinated, and they're so greedy. They're the ultimate in greed. And they're the ones that you find just with their chants. Everything for them is a chant, as if individually they're incapable of thinking.
It's the same kind of thing you get in churches with songs and the repetitive nature of it. It's the reason why Barney is so successful. You know, Barney the Dinosaur, it's repetitive songs that just drill into a kid's head. Religion uses it, chants are just another form of that.
Yep. Yeah, the most recent version of it, your daughter will soon fall in love with this little guy, is Benjamin Tiger. Daniel Tiger.
We've got her watching Mr. Rogers right now, and she loves Mr. Rogers.
Well, Daniel Tiger is Mr. Rogers. Literally. Daniel Tiger was created by Mr. Rogers, is Mr. Rogers.
Okay.
She will soon find that mesmerizing. It does the same thing with repetitive songs and slogans, and their children are just mesmerized by it. It does have a benefit in that the entire purpose of Daniel Tiger is to show how to work through interpersonal relationships, how to act with a brother or sister, mother, father, friend, what happens if you're sick, what happens if you're sad, what happens if you're frustrated, how to work through these interpersonal challenges. And, you know, for the most part, it's reasonable advice. But nonetheless, back to...
But, you know, repetition has its role. Repetition is great for remembering and learning something. But what you're repeating, that's the issue.
Yeah, I was spectacular at it, for example. He tells us what we need to know over and over and over again. And the more we hear it, the more likely we are to remember it. But I do want those in the covenant to remember this, that there's something very frightening happening in our country. When I saw the riots and the destructiveness and the people, the unthinking young people out in the streets with their chants and their signs, no Trump, no KKK, no fascist USA, I realized that could be the beginnings of what brought Russia and China down, left them in chaos, leading to the deaths of 100 million people between the two. That's what struck me at the time, and I had not seen, although there have been similar violent protests by Antifa around the country in many cities since that time. I had not seen it up close and personal, nor observed its tactics until I saw it in my hometown in Charlottesville, Virginia. And so I want to sound the alarm. I would also like to share something that was interesting to me today. A friend sent me the video, and I'd seen it before, of how if you assign the numerical values that the letters describe to certain words in Hebrew, the first three that he uses is moon, earth, and sun, and you compare those to the log E of the diameter of the three celestial bodies, that you find a direct correlation. And the first time I saw it, I dismissed it because I did not understand why the diameters, because I'm always concerned when somebody tells me about, you know, distances and things in the, or time, and they convey them in human units. You know, Yahweh doesn't speak of hours. There is no such thing as a mile in Yahweh's parlance. And so, unless the unit of measure is days or years, or the distance measure is a yard, a meter, a stride, if you will, that or a foot, or the cubit, which is from the elbow to the tip of the finger, unless it's converted into those kind of units of measure, I don't find it interesting. But to avoid the issues of unit of measure, and to make a comparison in a chart form, the log E, natural log E, was chosen as the means of comparing the numerical value of the words to the natural log E of the diameters of those three celestial bodies. So today, I decided, you know, the last time I dismissed this, I dismissed it because I didn't understand the reason for converting the diameters to the natural log. So I studied it a bit today. And I found there's some things really interesting about the natural log. The first is that it's based upon graphing where you begin at 1. It is precisely accurate at 1. The more one approaches 1, the more accurate the natural log E is. Yahweh is 1. The natural log E is designed so that if you know time, it will provide information regarding growth. If you know growth, it will deduce time. It's why it was probably designed by bankers who were trying to ascertain how often to compound interest to maximize their return. The return on interest is maximized with the daily compounding, and it maximizes at the natural log E. And it was the means to allow estimates prior to the invention of calculus of very complex relationships, and literally can transform very lengthy multiplication and division equations into simple addition and subtraction. It's a perfect tool when applied to Yahweh, as it's about the two things that Yahweh provides: time and growth. Really, if you look at the covenant, what do we get? Time,
eternity, and
growth.
Enrichment.
Right. Time and growth. And it's the way to ascertain one given the other. So then I watched the video, which I'm not prone to do very often, taking notes all the way through, so I had what they were talking about, verifying the mathematical numbering of the Hebrew words, and then the modeling of them on the chart, and the fact that the diameter of the Moon, Earth, and Sun, when charted, and compared to the value of the Hebrew words for Moon, Earth, and Sun, are exact. Exact. And you go, okay, what are the probability of that? Unless the words themselves were given a numerical value that provided a direct comparison of their relative size. You know, it's also interesting that, did you know that the moon is 400 times closer than the sun, and the moon is 400 times smaller than the sun?
That's part of what makes the perfect balance for our planet.
That is why we're going to get a full solar eclipse on Monday.
Monday.
But it is. But what did Yahweh provide? What two things did Yahweh provide for us to measure time?
The moon and the sun.
Correct. The measurement for a completion of a period of time from Yahweh's point of view is a multiple of what number?
Seven.
Nope.
Oh, wait, no.
Completion of a period of time from Yahweh. How many days and nights did it rain during the flood?
40.
40 or 400.
Yeah. Yeah. How many years were the Israelites tested as slaves in Mitzrayim, Egypt?
40.
400.
Mm-hmm.
400. How many days was the Torah delivered to Moshe by Yahweh on Mount Moriah?
40 days.
40. The moon is 400 times smaller than the sun. Said another way, the sun is 400 times larger than the moon, and the sun is 400 times further away than the moon. The two things that tell us how to measure times are multiples of 40 of each other, and the Hebrew words used to describe each of them, Yarach, Shemesh, and Eretz, when given numerical values and plotted in comparison to the natural log E of their diameter, is a perfect match. That was interesting. So that's how I spent my afternoon. And then I was debating whether or not it would be best to, because I finished a chapter on observations. I finished chapter 13. My guess is that that I shared chapter 12 so quietly that many don't even know that chapter 12 was completed some time ago, or that chapter 13 is now done. That was finished today, although it hasn't been really, hasn't received a final edit. Jackie and friends have gone through it several times, but I rewrote much of it and added a lot to it over these last the last week. I was debating whether or not I should continue to pursue Shemach, T-S-E-M-A-C-H. It can mean branch and thus be a title for both Dod and Yosha. It can symbolize the flourishing of plants that is going to take place when Yahweh returns and he transforms the earth, ridding it of all of man's pollution and creating a vibrant, lush, beautiful landscape like that which was witnessed in the Garden of Eden. It's used in that connotation. And it's also used to describe what happens to us as a result of the covenant, where we, Shemach, grow, flourish, live abundant lives. And I was pursuing it through from Yashaya 4, which is where I came across it, and did not know if I should render it with the title branch. By the way, the title branch is used a lot, many, many times more than the title Masayah, or Masayah even. Or should I render it growth, you know, the fervent growth that should I, and how does, you know, branch facilitate growth? And I ended up writing an entire chapter on this and went from Yashaya 4 through Dod's last psalm, which is the 132nd, where he concludes with Samek. He's sharing his relationship with Yahweh, and it the crescendo is how it leads to Samek, to growth, and the realization that Dode is the ultimate branch. And then I recognized that it was in what is in my favorite and least favorite chapter of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. They're one and the same. It's Yashaya 23. It's the most overt condemnation of religion to be found in God's voice. And it appears early in that chapter, about the fourth statement in that chapter. We see Shebek as the benefit of those who heed this message and who embrace Yahweh as opposed to embracing the words of man. But went through all of that, and now I was left with the choice. Do we continue to pursue this, the meaning of the branch, the meaning of the growth that emanates from it, the correlation between Dode and Yosha and the branch, and why both are represent the branch? And that would take us through Zechariah, particularly the early chapters. The first six chapters of Zechariah are really devoted to understanding who the branch is, what the branch represents. Or do we return and follow the original mission of observation, which was to move all the way through Yashaya through the 14th chapter so that we have a full understanding of who the adversary is, who the whore of Babylon is, what Babylon represents, what the correlation is between Hasatan, Babel, religion in general, Pauline Christianity, and this whore. Because it's all presented in the first 14 chapters of Yashaya. And so as I was having that debate, I said, you know, I think I probably better reread the fifth chapter of Yashaya. And it was interesting in that it begins with a story, a parable. And the parable is of God himself planting this this marvelous vineyard. And that he's talks about placing this vineyard. And in fact, it's actually God saying, I'm singing about this vineyard. And I placed it on the most fertile hill. And yet the vineyard was overturned by man. And then he explains that the parable of this vineyard and it being overturned by man and ruined, so there was nothing but bad fruit from it, was really the consequence of religion. And guess who makes an appearance in the midst of his condemnation of religion? Shaul, right there in the middle of his condemnation on religion, we find Shaul. And so, reading through this, I'm amazed to find that not only is Shaul mentioned, but directly after him, there is the realization that the whole world has rejected Yahweh's Torah.
Yes.
And that people have been driven away from him because they have rejected his Torah. And then there's a most interesting statement, one that I translated in the moments before the show today, that I want to share with you. And here is Pauline Christianity destroying Yahweh's vineyard. And doing so because man is ignorant of and has rejected Yahweh's Torah. And then Yahweh, in the last days, says the following. This is in his voice. It's in Yashaya's voice speaking about what Yahweh is going to do. It says, then, after the Torah has been rejected by the world, Then he will lift up a standard. It's a neck, a prominent sign or banner, hoisted up on an upright pole, serving as an ensign and signal to convey important information, which should be followed to bring people into the proper encampment. It's masculine singular. It's from Nakak and Naka, which is meaning that which is anointed, set apart, prepared, designated and authorized to serve by pouring out proof which can be tested. So then he will lift up a standard for the Gentile nations, La Ha Goyim, to approach and on behalf of a confluence of many different people living outside of Yisrael, doing so from far away, from Min Rakok, from afar, from a great distance away, in the distant future of the time of this writing. And he will use nonverbal communication to attract attention to it. From the ends of the earth, from the far extremities of the earth into the limits of time. And behold, this will occur in a very brief period of time, and at the speed of light, it will come. So, fellas, what do you think he's talking about there?
Yahusha? Return?
Yahusha's not going to before Yah was returned. He's not going to, he's most certainly not going to appear at this time. Now, this is at a time where man has been wholly rejected the Torah and has fallen prey to Pauline Christianity, and the earth is beginning to descend into chaos. He's talking about now. Right now. So he will lift up a standard, an important means to communicate, which should be followed to bring people into the proper encampment. This thing that is anointed, set apart, prepared, designated, and authorized to serve by pouring out proof which can be tested. It's for people living in the Gentile nations. He's going to set this thing up from far away. The Torah he'd reveal, if he's going to reveal the Torah himself, the Ten Statements in Stone, that's during the end of the tribulation, and it's right in the midst of Yisrael. No, it's not. And it's for Yisrael to see. This is for people, could be Yehudim, could be Yisraelites, but those who are living in the Gentile nations to see. This is lifted up by Yahweh in the last days, after people have rejected his Torah, from a place that's very far away from Yisrael. It can be seen by everyone on earth. It is singular. And it is compiled in a very brief period of time relative to the whole fabric of time. And it arrives at the speed of light. What do you think he's talking about?
I'm lost.
What besides Yada Yah, an introduction to God, observations, attacks, questioning Paul, attacks the very foe that God has pointed out that has upended his garden, calling Christianity, and that serves as something that Yahweh himself will lift up and draw attention to, that can be seen by the whole world and arrives at the speed of light.
Well, the internet carries all this information, so anybody could see it at the speed of light.
Yeah. Yep.
I didn't want to go there. I mean, just kind of... But that's what I thought of.
It's uncomfortable to go there.
Yeah,
I read it and said, okay, boy, that seems to point right at what we're doing. But What else could it be?
Everything revolves around His Word, and all we've done to the poem. English is the second language for just about the whole world. Game
Correct.
Flying airplane lets you speak English, you know, to
Correct.
Help with towers and all that. So that's the language.
Yep.
And it's in that language. And we make no claims. Isn't that inspired talk? This is Yahweh just translation. So anybody.
.com, it's English. .org, it's, .net. They're all English words. You know, developed in the United States of America. The reluctance to go there, of course, is that you could say, all right, so here you're claiming that God is speaking of something that we've done. But that's not the way that I saw this. This says that it's not what we have done, it's what He has done.
Mm-hmm.
He has made this ensign, this signal, this sign visible. He's lifted it up. He has drawn attention to it. He has made it available for the entire world to see. It's His words. And it's His words conveyed the way that He wants His words conveyed. His words are always conveyed through flawed individuals. Always, 100% of the time. Now, there is this tendency to say, let's not go there because the individuals responsible might get haughty. Thinking, oh wow, I'm being used by God. Isn't that great? No. When you know Yahweh, you don't get haughty over that because you know that Yahweh only works with flawed people. He only uses flawed implements.
You know,
the only reason you're qualified to work with them is because you're unqualified. Okay.
Well put. Okay, so, I can go with that.
So you can discard any potential for ego creeping into. He's talking about us. Because there's no reason for pride other than our enthusiasm in what we're doing with Yahweh. And this has Him drawing attention to it, as Him lifting it up, and it's His means to share with the world from a faraway place at the end of time on behalf of His people who have been exiled, sent away from Him because of their ignorance of His Torah and because of the great damage that has been done by Shaul and Pauline Christianity.
Well, we've hit
you
that
put all those things together. What else could it be? So that was a most interesting experience today. I'm fascinated by that, by the opportunity to continue to pursue it, particularly since there is such a marvelous parable that begins Yeshayah 5, and then a marvelous explanation. It's kind of like the Daniel prophecy, where Daniel is shown the images of the four beasts.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fifth beast is described, which is the Roman Catholic Church, and then Gabriel says, I don't want there to be any chance whatsoever that you're going to get this wrong, because of these five beasts, only one of them currently exists, and so it would be
narrows it down.
Yeah, I don't want there to be anybody who says, oh, come on, you're extrapolating here. And so he specifically ascribes a name to each of the beasts, and of course it is Babylon, Media Persia, Alexander, Greece, followed by Imperial Rome and Roman Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the way that he communicates in Yashaya 5. I'm going to tell you this story, and I'm going to use grapes in a vineyard planted on a hill for my beloved that were became sour as a result of men. And I'm going to use that analysis, that parable, and then I'm going to fill in the blanks for you. I'm going to tell you, well, it's Pauline Christianity. It's rabbinic Judaism. It's the religion of man that ruined my vineyard and caused the people to be sent away from me because they are ignorant of and have rejected my Torah. And it's so interesting in Yashaya, you know, over the chasm of time, you know, probably for a better part of 2,000 years, Yahweh was saying, I'm looking for someone I can communicate with. Somebody I can communicate through. I can't find anyone. So, it is interesting to consider what place we may have in that. It's even interesting, too, is that when it speaks of it coming at the speed of light, that the inference is that it's not well received, that it's demeaned and slighted and considered worthless by many. I never had any idea as to how worthless it is considered until I read the posts at UT when we were doing our expose on UT, and more recently Fred's comments as he continues to promote anti-Semitism and all manner of government conspiracies. Craig and his translations are not well received in such places. So I really had no ideas to, and they both have large followings. So it fit from that point of view as well. I look forward to going through Yashaya 23. I think perhaps we'll save that, and we'll return to the history of errant translations. But I do want to say it's a real treat. It was it is my favorite chapter and my least favorite chapter because of the fact. My favorite because it is so overt, and explaining what he doesn't like and what he doesn't like religion.
So you're going to shift to the Shemek?
I'm going to do that on a future date. I'm going to continue with the errant Bible translations because I think that is an essential element in helping people understand that they can't trust what they're reading, particularly in the Christian New Testament. With this information, if a person is open-minded and rational, they will recognize they've been played for fools by their church, by their religion.
Mm-hmm.
And until someone comes to recognize they cannot trust their holy Bible, that they cannot trust the institutions underlying their religion, the religious publishers, religious Bible publications, the pastors that read from them, the seminaries that teach people this rubbish, when they realize that almost everything about their religion is false and that it has been deliberately falsified to mislead them. Now, the notion of a church, there's no such word. The notion of gospel, there is no such word. They name Jesus, the name of Christ, no such animal. The idea of a Trinity, Christmas, Easter, Sunday worship, Christianity, all of those things, calling God the Lord, all of that.
Or even that Paul was a messenger from God.
Oh, yeah, that half the Christian New Testament was written by a man that Yahweh specifically calls out by name to say he's the plague of death.
Yeah. That's in the... Car 26, after he says, I'm going to chase all you people away, and you're going to run even when nobody's chasing you, and such and such and such. And then he says, and I'm gonna stick the plague on you.
Yeah, boy, there is really nothing that has been more harmful to Israelites than the plague of Pauline Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Because Paul created Christianity as an attack on Jews. The enemy is Jews in Paul's letters. Throughout Paul's letters, the only enemy are Jews. And so Roman Catholicism, already having a hatred for Jews out of Imperial Rome, embraced Paul's hatred of Jews. And it was the plague that led to Jews being killed for hundreds, like thousands of years under the auspices of Roman Catholicism. And you know, recognize that the Germans that oversaw the concentration camps, the death camps, they were Christians.
Mm-hmm.
As Christians, they had no problem being Jew haters. In fact, Roman Catholics have taught children to call Jews Jesus killers for centuries. In fact, for better part of 2,000 years. Of course, it's just so astonishing.
I love the irony there.
Yeah, the irony because of two things. One is the Roman Catholic Church is, in fact, the rebranding of Imperial Rome. And it was Imperial Rome that performed the crucifixion, that had the authorization and carried out every aspect of the crucifixion. Imperial Rome, not the Jews. So the Roman Catholics have only themselves to blame for the killing of the body. But beyond that, the irony of why in the hell would you create a religion where the celebration is man killing God? If man can kill God, you don't have much of a God.
It ain't God.
I mean, this whole notion of Roman Catholicism is God on a stick. In fact, a dead God on a stick. It's kind of like combining the ventriloquist, Jeff Dunham, has two characters. One is Jose the Jalapeno, which is a jalapeno on a stick, and then Akbar the dead terrorist. If you combine Akbar the dead terrorist and Jose the Jalapeno on a stick, you got the Catholic crucifixion.
You got Catholicism.
You got Catholicism. Well, it's going to lift up the dead God on a stick. Let's celebrate us killing God and blame it on somebody else.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, the reason that our review of the English Bible, and we began with the origins of what I'll put in quotes, the Old Testament, is that it was derived from the Greek Septuagint, as that was reflected in the Latin Vulgate. And that's a serious problem, because the only people who surpassed the Greeks in their overt animosity toward Yehudim and Hebrew were the Romans. If we were to search the world for the two most inappropriate languages and cultures to communicate Hebrew ideas, we'd find none worse than Hellenes promoting Greek and religious Roman scribes writing in Latin. For those who have been led to believe, as Roman Catholicism has promoted, that the Latin Vulgate represents the Christ hanging between the two thieves. The thieves are the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek writing of the New Testament. You've been played for a fool. God calls Rome the most vicious beast in the history of humankind. He despises Rome. And the only beast that Yahweh depicts as more harmful, as more oppressive than Imperial Rome, is the beast that grew out of Imperial Rome, the Roman Catholic Church. God despises everything to do with Latin. And the last language on earth that God would ever try to communicate with through, apart from Latin, would be Greek, where most of the Greek language is based upon the names of the Greek gods. And that the Greek language was literally became the fabric of the sophist and the rhetoric and of Gnosticism, where words were used to depict this conflict between the spiritual and the flesh, the physical world. Gnosticism, the basis of Pauline Christianity, the basis of Paul's letters. It is not a language that Yahweh would use. It is a language that celebrates man, where Hebrew celebrates God. Greek is written from the perspective of the Greek philosophers, who were wrong, by the way, about most everything. You know, in the West, we have this tendency to view Greece as magnificent because of their the likes of Aristotle and Socrates, but they were Gnostics, and they were wrong. Their explanations of the natural world, of the spiritual world, were wholly and completely, totally wrong. They were warlike, they were religious. They were grotesquely immoral. And so, there isn't any chance that God spoke the language or wrote the language. Yahweh's message to humankind has always been provided in a singular language. Yosha only spoke one language, Hebrew. Even the one place where it says in the highly errant Christian New Testament that he spoke Aramaic, the one place where there is no chance whatsoever that he was speaking Aramaic, but he was quoting the opening line that Dode wrote in the 22nd Mizmor, which was written in Hebrew. My God, why have you forsaken me? Every word of it Hebrew. And we spent a goodly amount of time in our last program explaining the history of the Septuagint. And just by quick summary, the legend that the Septuagint was written by 72 scholars, six each from the 12 tribes, and was promoted by a pagan Greek king, Ptolemy, on behalf of filling his library with another text, is completely bogus. The letter is an absolute hoax. It did not happen. And there is no credibility to the Septuagint, that because while the oldest documents are around 150 to 200 BCE, they're just tiny, tiny fragments. You know, we only have one fragment that dates to that time. By the time, it isn't until around 400 CE that we have enough of the Septuagint that we can actually say, well, this is the majority of it in a codex. 400 CE. So it is not something that is credible. It isn't something that is old. Now, as I had anticipated, when we came across the giants as opposed to Nephilim in the Latin Vulgate, and then in all early English Bibles, I had anticipated that, that Jerome simply replicated the Septuagint's mistake. Jerome despised Hebrew. He loved Greek. And the Vulgate, he wrote, Gigantes autem erant super terram in daedalus illis postquam enem ingress sut fili dia ad filis hominem illic gerant isti sent postes seculo veri famosi, which I'm sure I butchered, but translates as, now giants were upon the earth in those days. For after the sons of God went into the daughters of men, I don't know how you went into. That's kind of, that's one of like those freaky things. What was the, like the movie, The Matrix, you know, where this, you know, person is seen actually going right through another person. I guess they were, it was the precursor to The Matrix. For after the sons of God went into the daughters of men, and they brought forth children, these are the mighty men of old, men of renown. So the giant legend in the Latin Vulgate is derived from the error that is found in the Septuagint. In a moment, we'll study the long history of English Bible translations. But before we do, let's read some of the earliest and then a few of the most recent Bibles and consider what they offered as a translation of Barashi 6:4. Following the Septuagint and Vulgate, Wycliffe, who was the first to translate the Latin into Anglo-Saxon, a precursor to English on behalf of the common man, wrote, "Soothly, giants were on the earth in those days. Forsooth, after that, the sons of God entered in to the daughters of men, and those daughters begat. These were mighty of the world and famous men." And parenthetical, they were the mighty and famous men of the world. Well, while his heart was in the right place, his words were not. The next to publish, Tyndale, composed, "There were tyrantes in the world in those days. For after that, the children of God had gone into the daughters of men, and they had begotten them children. The same children were the mightiest of the world and men of renown." Well, it would be natural to assume that tyrantes was meant to be tyrants, as in ruthless despots, since the Tyndale Bible renders the same word in Bar Midbah, Numbers 13:13, as giants. We'd be closer to the truth with the assumption that the attempt was to depict beasts who were frighteningly terrible. The third oldest English Bible translation was composed by a fellow named Cloverdale, although he copied Tyndale word for word. His renditions of Genesis 6:4 and Numbers 13:13 echo the same mistakes made by his mentor. Thereafter, we find the next four English translations, put that in air quotes, slavishly returning to the familiar pattern of the Latin Vulgate. Without exception, they all replicated the errant rendering of Ha Nephilim found in the Septuagint and thereby plagiarized Wycliffe's efforts. King Henry VIII's Great Bible reads giants, as does Queen Elizabeth's Bishop Bible. The resolutely Protestant Geneva Bible, which was next in line, demonstrating its adherence to the Latin of the church they opposed, proposed, "There were giants," and then there's the letter G as a subscript, "in the earth in those days. Yea, after that, the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they had borne them children. These were mighty men, which in old time were of renown." Footnote G says, "or tyrants," an ode to Tyndale. And footnote H, which is at the end, reads, "which usurped authority over others and did degenerate from that simplicity wherein their fathers lived. I don't know if that was helpful or accurate, but there was the continued promotion of a lie. And you might say, oh, so what's the big deal about falsely rendering ha-Nephilim? Remember, Nephilim is the plural of Nephal. Nephal means to bow down, to prostrate oneself in prayer, and to engage in warlike matters and suffer a premature death. It speaks of religious-inspired fighting. The word that we're so familiar with today that is religious fighting is jihad. Nephilim would be a precursor to jihad, religious fighting. Except God doesn't think it's good. He thinks it's really bad, which is probably why Satan, as Allah, loves jihad. Well, Yahweh despised the Nephilim, these religious soldiers, to such a degree that he wiped them out. That's what the purpose of the flood was. So, it's not only that the truth is hidden, that we don't understand that the Nephilim would later come to represent the vicious nature of Imperial Rome and Roman Catholicism, but also the viciousness of Islamic terrorism and jihadists. And so we're precluded from that insight by rendering it as giants. And by changing the word Nephilim to giants, what else happens, fellas, that is counterproductive?
Well, then you create that thing that the demons, the fallen angels, are involved in this thing, create.
Partly is because people review this from the perspective of the fraud known as Enoch, and they come up with the stupidity that it's angels that are fornicating with human women, and they're conceiving super life forms.
But it's interesting how
the problem here is that is twofold. One is that there were no giants. Never have been any giants. Weren't giants back then, 5,000 years ago.
Okay. Giant's a bit subjective of a term. Being a shorter guy, I walk up to someone like Shaquille O'Neal. That's a giant to me.
Yeah. What this is infers is there was a whole population of giants.
Active creatures.
No, and
so you go back to Enoch, where a lot of this comes from. You're talking about several hundred feet people.
The giants in Enoch are actually described. I think they're 5,000 feet tall, but not
mistaken. Yeah, absurdly high. I can't remember the number, but
so this depicts beings that never existed. They were never a race of giants, ever.
But you notice that
the ancient peoples that lived at this time, particularly around the Black Sea and the areas being described here, the average height of a man was closer to 5 feet than 6 feet.
Yeah, if anything,
and certainly not 7 feet. Yeah, when you consider Shaquille O'Neal to be a giant, he's 7 feet.
That's giant to me.
Okay, and you know, and if you're 6 feet tall, 7 feet tall is a giant. If you're under 6 feet, then it's really a super giant. But that's not what the term though implies here. And so by putting it in, it makes the Torah untrue.
It makes a mockery of God's word.
That is correct. And
but don't you think they're kind of added because they are the religious warriors and they don't want you to associate them with this if they translated it right? Then
if they translated it correct, Phila speaks of onward Christian soldiers.
Right.
It speaks of jihad. You know, it speaks of God support our troops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what America's patriotism and and worship of its military. It's honor that it bequeaths those who serve in the military. Is the same mindset, and the building of this massive military in America and then deploying it is the same mindset that Yahweh is denouncing with Nephilim. So yeah, the actual meaning of Nephilim hits way too close to home for those that lived in militant Britain, militant Spain, militant France, militant Germany, super militant Rome, militant Greece, the militants of Roman Catholicism. The militants of America. It hits way too close to home to be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So a Greek scribe made a mistake. And then a Latin author, the author of the Vulgate, Jerome, copied his mistake. And then each of the English translations thereafter replicated that same mistake. It's just like, why don't you find a English translation for me that presents Adam's wife by her correct name?
I can't find one. Honestly.
And it's not that it's a bad transliteration. You can't get from Chawa, which is the Hebrew word for life, mother of life, source of life, life giver, to Eve. Eve was is Mother Earth. Mother Earth goddess is Eve. And it's just an absolute blatant change. It's like changing the Greek word ecclesia to church, or the Greek word euangelion to gospel. It's a complete and utter change. It's like the change of charis, the charities, to grace, even though the Roman variation of them were the gratia. There is no excuse for it. It's just an absolute change. Now, the first Roman Catholic English translation of the Latin Vulgate, of course, was known as the Douay Rheims. It offered, now giants were upon the earth in those days, for after the sons of God went into the daughters of men, and they brought forth children, these are the mighty men of old, men of renown. They're actually Gabor. They're heroic warriors and political leaders. Proving that the King James made no attempt to translate the Hebrew text, but simply plagiarized earlier translations, the Latin Vulgate, the King's Minions, published, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, and they became mighty men, which were of old men of renown. I had a friend send me a more comprehensive introduction to the 1609 King James, explaining its origins. He sent it to me because, I was reading one of your chapters on the history of the King James, where you had cited that it was devoted to their great Zion, James, who at the time was King Iams. In fact, Yosha's brother was even renamed, given the king's name. That's why you find the book of James. It goes into great detail about the Septuagint and the lies that were promoted regarding it, and Jerome's hatred of Hebrew. All the claims that I have made about the political origins of the King James are all detailed in this letter. I think it's been posted on a number of different sites, and it is a good read. It verifies everything that we're saying is true. Now, simply stated, the cast of alleged scholars who worked on the KJV were guilty of plagiarism. If students in their classes attempted such a thing, they would have received a failing grade and then been dismissed in shame from the school. Anytime someone copies someone else's work and passes it off as their own, they are wrong, even if the original answer was right. But when they copy an erroneous work, they not only reveal their ignorance, they reveal their character, proving that they cannot be trusted. Such is the case with the whole KJV, the most acclaimed and popular of all English translations. That is a sobering indictment, especially for those who are rational and moral. They copied the work of others, and the work they copied was wrong. That proves that they cannot be trusted. Thereafter, the Webster Bible parroted their predecessors. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, the same became mighty men who were of old men of renown. The Common English Bible towed the same line. In those days, giants lived on the earth, and also afterward, when divine being and human daughters had sexual relations and gave birth to children. These were the ancient heroes, famous men. This is saying that there was a class of humans that we've never seen any evidence of, that was only 5,000 years ago. They were the byproduct of a union between beings comprised of light and women comprised of flesh. Yeah. Have you ever seen what happens when a laser, which is intensified light, is used in conjunction with something material? What does it do?
Destroys it, cuts it.
Yeah. You ever seen how an advanced CNC machine works? You know, one of those Haas CNC machines? You know, there's some, the crudest types use drill bits. And then the next generation used water jets. You know, water is an unstoppable force.
Mm-hmm.
And the most effective of them, that can cut through anything, use light. You know, if light were to enter a human woman in that manner, it would destroy her. Yeah. And it most certainly cannot deliver a sperm. I suspect that those who are listening are noticing a trend. These mistakes were all copied from one to the next. To call them translations is to dishonor the word. And while they all proved that they cannot be trusted, no one seemed interested, willing, or able to hold them accountable. No one. Worse, I mean, this gets back to that ensign, that banner, the standard that is being lifted up by Yahweh for the whole world to see. No one has held them accountable. No one protested, saying that these lies and deceptions could possibly be the inerrant word of God. There were no giants. Divine beings did not mate with humans. Now that we've considered the oldest English Bibles, let's see what time has wrought. Surely most recent translations will be more accurate, right? They all claim to be based on the Dead Sea Scrolls. In Young's literal translation, after Jehovah saith and before Jehovah seeth, we find the fallen ones were in the earth in those days, and even afterwards when the Son of God came into the daughters of men, and they born to them, they are the heroes who, from of old, are the men of name. Well, at least Shem was literally rendered. As for Jehovah, they got one of the four letters right. Fallen ones is kind of an interesting rendering of Nephilim, because Nephilim mean to fall down. It means to prostrate oneself in prayer or to fall in battle. but again, it was used as a title. You know, it's like rather than saying the Americans, saying those from the land, which is what the Indian means, of a mare, speaking of the sun god of the Aztecs. No. You know, it is a title. It describes the name of the people. You can translate the name to explain its meaning, but you better transliterate it as a title. The Good News translation had bad news. The authors of this modern paraphrase proposed in those days and even later, there were giants on the earth who were descendants of human women and heavenly beings. They were the great heroes and famous men of long ago. This, of course, is invalid in every conceivable way. There were no giants on the earth then or later, and God did not say or infer that they existed. The GNT completely, the Good News translation, completely disposed of the phrase sons of the Almighty and replaced it with heavenly beings. Not only such beings are, the only such beings are Moloch, and they did not engage in sex, and Yahweh did not use the term Moloch. They are comprised of light and serve as Yahweh's implements and messengers. There are no heroes in this story, and Yahweh was not addressing fame. It is reprehensible that men sold this rubbish as the word of God. For those who may be chafing at the bit to challenge the notions that there were no giants on the earth then or later because Goliath was called a giant, I would argue that one particularly large individual does not define a race. And since archaeologists have just recently unearthed the first evidence of a Philistine gravesite, they have proof that these invaders were of average height for their time, with men averaging just over 5 feet. If one of these men had been 6 feet, if Goliath was 6 feet, he would have seemed like a giant to everyone else compared to those he was living with. Beyond this, the Masoretic text is corrected by the Dead Sea Scrolls with regard to Goliath's height. The Masoretic text reads 6 cubits and a span. A cubit was measured from the elbow to the tip of the fingers and therefore averaged 16 to 18 inches. A span was the width of the hand, or 6 to 9 inches, depending upon whether it was measured across the palm or from an extended thumb to little finger. Therefore, the rabbinical text would have Goliath standing 9 feet 9 inches tall, but according to 4Q5:1 Shamuel, a 1,200-year-older manuscript found in the caves above Qumran, his height was actually 4 cubits and a span, and thus only 6 feet tall. So while that would have made him nearly a foot taller than the average Philistine or Israelite, he was only a giant from the perspective of lesser men. Isn't that interesting that the Dead Sea Scrolls in this particular case, 4Q5, which is the name of the scroll of 1 Samuel, which is 1,200 years older than the Masoretic text, has Goliath at 6 feet tall, 6 feet even. Where
to be considered a closer to average, yeah, slightly above average today, but
slightly above average today, a foot taller than the average Philistine, because they can now be measured because we've finally unearthed a Philistine grave. But the Masoretic text had him standing 9 feet 9 inches tall. Never been a person 9 feet 9 inches tall. Goliath wasn't 9 feet 9 inches tall; it was 6 feet.
I think the record was something like 8'6". The guy had like a normal, you know, a ton of back problems and health issues related to that.
Part of it is a pituitary problem, and you could have somebody, but they couldn't move; they would hardly be a soldier or a warrior.
Yeah,
most of the
time. I think of that with all sorts of modern accoutrements, special shoes, special diet, special exercise programs. It's possible at 7 feet to 7'2" in that range to still be a functional human being. Although, you know, you look at most of the really tall individuals and you know, serious problems from their health and mobility. Their feet fail, their knees fail, their backs fail. But anything over that, Goliath would have been a pushover had he been above 7 feet in his day. It would not have taken a stone from a sling. A good wind would have toppled him. He was 6 feet tall. There were no giants. There's no history of giants. Now, returning to the myths promoted by the religious, in the Living Bible, we find, in those days, and even afterwards, when the evil beings for the spirit world were sexually involved with human women, their children became giants, of whom so many legends are told. Now, can you imagine being so despicable that you would attribute this to the Word of God? In those days and even afterwards, when the evil beings for the spirit world were sexually involved with human women, their children became giants of whom many legends are told. I mean, there is no part of that that coincides with the Hebrew text. And at the time that was published, they had full access to the Hebrew text and even to the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's hard to imagine anything worse than the Good News translation. Well, that was until reading the Living Bible. Its tradition is despicable.
Always the worst of the bunch.
Wholly unjustified. It makes God out to be a nincompoop, nearly as dumb and perverted as his creation. Other than the opening phrase, which was out of order, they didn't get anything right. The message of the Bible called the Message became, this was black. This was bad. This was, yeah, blah, blah. I'll learn to talk one of these days. You know, that's the very fact that I could not read the Latin, I mumbled all over myself, and I can't read my own writing here, is proof that I'm perfectly qualified to do this job, just as Moshe was qualified with his speech impediment. So I wear this badge with a sense of dedication. It's the only time you can laugh about and feel good about not being very good at doing this. This was back in the days, and also later, when there were giants in the land. The giants came from the union of the sons of God and the daughters of men. These were the mighty men of ancient lore, the famous ones. With all evidence to the contrary, we're still mired in ignorance and carelessness of the Septuagint and Vulgate. Laughably, the most recent English variation, the New Living Translation, they offered, in those days, and for some time thereafter, giant Nephilites lived on the earth.
They gave them a race now.
giant Nephilites.
Oh, crap. The Amorites and the Nephilites.
You know, if they just said the Nephilites, then they might have had something.
They might have a quick case.
But the giant Nephilites, they're trying to accommodate the mistakes of the previous translations. Giant Nephilites lived on the earth, for whenever the sons of God had intercourse with women, they gave birth to children who became the heroes and famous warriors of ancient times.
That's all the makings of a Greek myth. Nothing of truth.
Yeah, why don't we just...
Mars is on the hill and everybody's fighting against
Mars. Yeah, why don't we just quote from the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey, and call it the Word of God. You know, why don't we do what Paul did and quote from Dionysus, his comment from his flashing light on the road to Damascus was, it's difficult to kick against the goat. The most famous line that Dionysus is said to have ever uttered. And it's the same level of stupidity here. It'd be funny if it wasn't so sad, but it's depressing because these money-grubbing religious imbeciles perpetrated their fraud in the name of God. They ascribed their verbal diarrhea to the creator of the universe. In the process, they made God out to be a liar. Thankfully, there's a consequence for doing such things. They will pay a price as a result. While it would have been difficult for some, and that the Masoretic text wasn't readily available to them, you know, it's interesting that Codex Leningradus, which is the only remotely accurate variation of the Masoretic. The Masoretic is not monolithic. It's kind of like the Septuagint, not as bad as Septuagint, but somewhat like the Septuagint, and that the more copies you have, the less credible it becomes. And the most credible, the most accurate copy of the Masoretic is the Codex Leningradus, which wasn't found until and published until 100 years ago or so. Yeah, it was found and published long after the King James was written. So there was no, even if they wanted to go to an accurate Hebrew translation. Hebrew is not a translation. If they went to go to an accurate Hebrew script, the Masoretic and its Codex Leningradus, which is the most accurate, was written at Leningrad. That's where it was found, which is why it's given that title. Mm-hmm. Most likely was written by those who worked with Maimonides. Maimonides, you know, began in Spain until the Muslims in Spain became ruthless on the Jews, and then he moved to Morocco, and then ultimately into Egypt. And one of his scribes, or those that would follow his teachings thereafter, it would be the author of that, of a copy of the Codex Leningradus, and it was not available. Of course, none of the Dead Sea Scrolls were available. So they had no means to translate the Hebrew. They didn't have an accurate, even remotely accurate Hebrew text. And it wouldn't have mattered because none of them could read or write Hebrew. And it wouldn't have mattered because they viewed Hebrew with the same disdain they viewed Israelites and Yahweh himself. And so they could, if they wished, check very late, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th century CE copies of the Septuagint, or in most cases they simply referred to the Latin Vulgate, or in the vast number of cases, as the introduction to the King James reveals, they simply revised what they found to be objectionable and prior translations. They copied the prior translation until they came up to something that they found objectionable and then changed that, but without any reference to the Hebrew. So that's why you have this cacophony of lies. So it would have taken a considerable effort back in the day to recognize that the phylum, they were not giants. In fact, they were the opposite of giants. Rather than standing tall, they were bowing down in religion and falling down in battle. And so it would have been more difficult to create an accurate transcript. One of the reasons I say I think we live in the best of all times. If you want to know Yahweh, there's no easier time to know him than it is right now. And so they simply chose to parrot their predecessors, which if they had announced that is what we're doing, that'd be one thing. You know, to say, you know, we don't have access to the Hebrew, we don't understand Hebrew, we don't like Hebrew, and so what we're doing is we're revising our predecessors, and we recognize that they were translations of the Latin, and the Latin was a translation of the Greek, and we're so far removed from the original Hebrew that, you know, chances are we're not very accurate here. And if they'd been honest about it, it'd have been one thing. So even though there is absolute proof demonstrating there never have been a race of giants, they continued to attribute this lie to God, hoping that Christians would buy their corruptions. And let's be clear. These purported translations have gone from bad to worse. The last four were even more despicable than the initial four. But that is the nature of things. Once something is perverted, it never gets better. Think of the 200,000 variations, perversions between the oldest manuscripts and the Textus Receptus and the Nestle-Aland. Once you lose textual integrity, it just simply gets worse. You know, it's like taking a deck of cards that are organized by number, by suit, and tossing them out an airplane window at 5,000 feet and expecting them to land on the ground back assorted by number and suit as opposed to being strewn all over the landscape. When things become perverted, it never gets better. Since we are now confronted by the collective malfeasance of religious translators, or should we say copyists and plagiarizers, let's affirm something I discovered through research a number of years ago. The first English translations of the Bible were derived from Latin, not Greek, and most certainly not from Hebrew. They were all based on the Roman Catholic Church's Vulgate, which itself was an amalgamation of old Latin manuscripts. While Jerome, his actual name was Eusebius Hieronymus Sopharimus, completed, I don't know how they got Jerome out of that. So Eusebius was his first name. Sophronius was his last name. How do you get Jerome out of that?
Well, you can't even find a J until another three, what, how many more years? Another thousand years?
And Sophronius would be this name that echoes the sentiments of the sophists, the philosophers, the Greek philosophers that were advocating Gnosticism.
Well, I think you or James came up with erroneous last time we talked, so.
Yeah. When you put it all together, it's it begins with the beginning and the end of it is erroneous. His name, Eusebius Sophronius, would be erroneous. That would be a contraction of his name. See how you'd put that into the actual text of the book. Or for short, erroneous. Completed his blending process in 405 CE. It's the letter he wrote to Pope Damascus of all names, by the way.
Yeah,
I know, Damascus. That should have obliterated the credibility of Christianity before it was imposed by Rome. This is a letter that Erroneous wrote to Pope Damascus. If we are to pin our faith to the Latin text, if we are to pin our faith to the Latin text, not the Hebrew, not the Greek, our faith to the Latin text, it is for our opponents to tell us which. For there are almost as many forms of text as there are copies. What he's saying there is that the old Latin translations of the Greek had become so many and so varied that all one had to do to destroy the credibility of Christianity and the Roman Catholic Church is to say you have no textual integrity. There are as many variations
of that
as there are.
I'll go with this one.
That's right.
You get that in Christianity Today. Oh, well, that's
right.
What it says in the King James, but the New Living Translation says this, and I go with that.
Yeah. But this wasn't a difference in translation as it was just a complete... In English, there's the acknowledgement that it is a translation of another language. In the Greek, in the case of the Christian New Testament, and they don't know what language, but it was actually Latin as it relates to the what they call the Old Testament. But here the Roman Catholic Church is trying to say Latin is the language that we're going to pin our faith to. We're going to establish our faith based upon Latin. And in the Latin, there were so many variations that they had no credibility. It says, if on the other hand, we are to glean the truth from a comparison of many, why not go back to the original Greek and correct the mistakes introduced by inaccurate translators and the blundering alterations of confident but ignorant critics, and further, all that has been inserted or changed by the copyist more asleep than awake. What they're telling you here is that Latin writers cannot be trusted. I discovered this when I was doing the history of Rome. I wanted to understand why God called Imperial Rome and then the Roman Catholic Church the most vile and vicious and oppressive beasts in the history of humankind. And what I learned is that at this time, going from around the time of Hadrian to the time of Theodosius, from 100 CE to 400 CE, that the whole of the Roman quote-unquote historians were storytellers. And their stories had almost no basis in historical fact. They presented the world as they wanted the world to be seen. And they were stunningly anti-Semitic. Hated Yehuda. And so he's saying that those who were the Latin scribes conveying, and this was only the Christian New Testament, conveying the Christian New Testament, couldn't be trusted. They were asleep. They had their own agenda. They wrote whatever they wanted to write. They introduced all manner of corruptions. But what he's not recognizing here, and what he did not say, is you can't go back to the Greek because the Greek suffered exactly the same fate. We know that for fact because when we compare the oldest manuscripts, those prior to this time, prior to Constantine, in 325 CE, they vary in every possible way, or in wholesale conflict with one another. And those after Constantine, after 325 CE, are so contrary to those before 25 CE, they can't even be compared. And so you can't go back to the Greek to find the original, because the Greek was even more polluted, even more unreliable than was the Latin. There was no original Greek available around 400 CE. The existing manuscripts were so grotesquely errant. By that time, it was called the Free School. It was the school that was introduced by Marcion. But the other thing is that this notion that if you were to go into a polluted swamp where everything is corrupt, that somehow you can pull a living goose out of a bunch of rotting goose turds. I mean, you, this is the very opposite of what God said. You can't get good out of distilling bad.
Bad fruit.
Yeah, a whole table full of bowls of bad does not one bowl of good create. But of course, what he's saying here is quite simply, Roman Catholicism will be based on Latin, and the Latin texts are so corrupt and so varied, based upon the bungling of scribes who were more asleep than awake, but also by those who deliberately altered it, that there is no credibility. So what he's going to do is he's going to replace the many with one, and that one's going to be considered authorized by the Pope. It's exactly what happened with the Quran. The oldest hadith have variations of Muhammad's surahs being recited to him. And Muhammad said, you know, I like that one better than this one. Somebody asked Muhammad about which one was right, and he said, you know, these surahs, they're more fleeting than a runaway camel. He couldn't remember them. No one could remember them. And so what you end up with was these wild variations. In fact, the oldest copies of the Quran were found in an attic in a mosque in Yemen. And would Gert Bruin publish pictures of them to demonstrate that they were hugely different than today's Quran. It destroyed the basis of Islam, which is that the Quran is word for word as God penned it in heaven, and it was given to Muhammad because there's only one Quran, and therefore it's perfect. Yeah. There's only one. If you destroy all, which they did in Islam, if you destroy all the variations, that's what Jerome was saying. If we destroy all the variations and all the conflicting texts, so that no one has access to them, and we create one that is our own, that we say this is the one and only, then we control the argument.
Well, it's not unlikely.
It's not easy to win the argument when you're the one in control of the facts.
That is correct.
You change the facts, you win the argument. That's easy.
That's exactly what Jerome is telling Pope Damascus. If we have complete control over all of the evidence, and no one else has any access to the evidence, and that our evidence is the only authorized evidence, we win every argument. That letter alone ought to destroy all of Christianity's credibility. Now, as I said, the mission was the same as it would be for Islam's Quran 300 years later. Congeal many divergent texts into one authorized version so that it can be promoted as the inerrant word of God. If people are given choices, they tend to think independently, and that's not in the interest of those who wield power. If discrepancies are allowed, they lead to questions and ultimately to questioning authority. Jerome's, or shall we call him erroneous, mission was to eliminate the competition by forestalling criticism. He and his overlords would control the text, constraining people's access to God's word, interpreting it as they pleased, while claiming that it empowered them and them alone. And they would do so in their language, the tongue of the beast, Rome's Latin. Not Yahweh's Hebrew, not even Shaul's Greek. But that was just the motive for the crime of the millennia. And of course, the consequence. And yet the most alarming part of this declaration wasn't even that the Christian religion's most important individual, relative to the documentation of its New Testament scriptures, put all that in quotes, admitted that by the late 4th century, there were already many forms, variations, mistakes, and changes in the Latin text comprising the Christian New Testament. While devastating to Christendom's credibility, the very foundation of the Roman Catholic Church and thus Christendom, and the veracity of its New Testament crumbles with the realization that the myriad of errors were the result of inaccurate translators and unduly confident and ignorant clerics who blundered their way to copious alterations based upon the legacy of comatose copyists. And in this characterization, Jerome was somewhat correct. While he and his church destroyed the variant Latin manuscripts, the variants is found among the 69 pre-Constantine Greek manuscripts tell the exact same story. It should have been game over for Christianity. Seeking credibility, it destroyed it. If you're awake, if your mind is open, if you're rational, upon hearing this, you should reject Christianity and the Christian New Testament if you haven't done so already. The very foundation of the religion is fraudulent, predicated on a deliberate babble, mixing together of inconsistent and conflicting hearsay testimony. Apart from the Greek Orthodox Church and the Copts in Egypt, the Vulgate served as the foundation of Christianity for over 1,000 years. And now we know that the text was a deliberate amalgamation of errors, the product of acknowledged ignorance, the result of accepting blunders. Those who promoted it cannot and should not be trusted. If you believe what they concocted out of incongruous material, if your faith is based upon the message they manipulated, you are a fool. The variances between the late 4th and early 5th century Greek manuscripts of the Christian New Testament are overwhelming. Something Jerome, erroneous in our parlance, should have known as a Greek scholar. But he deliberately omitted this from his letter to Pope Damascus. A score of unreliable, inconsistent, and incompatible Greek texts cannot be used as a means to fix the problem of discordant Latin texts. One does not derive truth by distilling a vast array of errors into a single amalgamation of those many mistakes. This obliterates the myth held by Christians that God would never allow his word to be corrupted. Sorry. But facts are facts. Putting Paul's disagreements with Yosha aside for a moment, there has never been a time when the foundational texts of the Christian New Testament agreed with one another. As a result, God either allowed the Christian New Testament to be corrupted because he had nothing to do with it in the first place, or he was impotent and thus unable to stop the unfathomable number of alterations. And in this case, only the initial option is viable, because faith in a God incapable of providing mankind with a credible text is a fool's folly. Faith is therefore required because knowledge resulting in trust is impossible. That means that God had nothing to do with the Christian New Testament. Now, since the points that I've just made are logically irrefutable, there was absolutely no chance whatsoever that Eusebius, Jerome, could have somehow resolved the inaccuracies and blunders found in the early Latin texts of the Christian New Testament by referring to Greek manuscripts, especially since he errantly claimed in his letter to his pope that the Greek represented the original language. Truth cannot be derived from a false premise. Even the words spoken by Yosha were in Hebrew. It was the original language of Yosha. The disciples spoke and wrote in Hebrew. Greek was not the original language. Yosha never spoke Greek. Now we'll discuss more of the implications of this in a moment relative to the church's most important citation. The so-called Christian New Testament Greek copyists work in the same places for the same political and religious institutions at the same time as those who had butchered the Latin translations. They were equally incompetent. But, and this bears repeating, unlike the Latin, where the divergent manuscripts were destroyed to hide the evidence of this crime, we have absolute and irrefutable proof that the Greek translators and copyists created many forms and variations which were laden with mistakes and changes, and that their many errors and alterations and accuracies were the product of blundering and ignorant scribes. Over the past 50 years, 69 extant Greek copies of the Christian New Testament have been recovered and published, all dating from the early 2nd through the mid-4th century CE. They are not only substantially different with respect to each other, there are over 300,000 known variants between these early manuscripts and the Textus Receptus. The same is evident when the oldest manuscripts and extant papyri are compared to the Nestle Allen. The blended text, publishers claim, now underlies their more modern English translations. So while there is no reason to doubt Jerome's claim that the Latin texts were irreconcilably corrupt, we know for certain that the Greek manuscripts were already corrupt. They were nothing but a blend of errors, all in disagreement with one another. Now, since the evidence in this regard is prolific and irrefutable, translations of the oldest Greek New Testament manuscripts, Philip Comfort, easy to buy. Read it for yourself. Do the comparison. It's not hard to do. It was absolute and irrefutable proof that this is true. And it completely obliterates Christianity's credibility for anyone who is aware of the evidence. Even if the scribes of the 3rd and 4th centuries had accurately maintained the text they were given, it still wouldn't have mattered. A perfect copy of an imperfect document remains invalid. It's like correctly copying an incorrect answer during a test. It's the Nephilim turned to giants over and over again. It's just wrong twice over. And since we are dealing with facts, not faith, let's accept the reality that half of the Christian New Testament was corrupt the moment the author's pen stained the papyrus. Paul's 13 letters are ungodly, invalid, and worse, demonic. But as we've discovered, that is a story for another book. As for the few Greek texts that have merit, Matanya, Iaokanon, and Revelation, they are now suspect because their value has been eroded by misguided translators and copyists. A glaring example of this would be the story of the adulterous woman told in John 8:1-11. The entire episode, including, "Let him who is without sin cast the first stone," was contrived in the 8th century CE. There is no record of it in any of the many hundreds, if not thousands, of manuscripts composed between the 1st and 8th centuries. Not one. The entire account was made up because Christians wanted their God to contradict the Torah.
Well, because if he didn't, then they would still be subject to it, and they can't have that.
That is correct.
That's Jewish.
So we're going to create a story, make it really visual and rife with details, that has the Christian Jesus contradicting the Torah. Simply stated, the Greek, Latin, and English texts of the Christian New Testament cannot be trusted. Manuscripts have been in constant state of degradation since it was first composed. This problem cannot be resolved or rationally refuted. Moreover, subsequent translations can be no more accurate than the underlying text, which we know is a jumbled mess of alterations from errant translations. Should you seek proof of this, read Philip Comfort's The Text of the Earliest New Testament Greek Manuscripts, where all 69 pre-Constantine manuscripts were presented for our consideration. Don't blame me for a lack of faith until you have observed the evidence. And the introduction to his book.
I don't need faith if I have evidence.
That's correct. But the Christian says, you just have a lack of faith for not believing that God would protect his word. No, I know the truth.
And you have no free will.
Well, the way I argue this to Christians is, you know, faith is belief without proof. And
I have proof.
I understand where people come from with that.
That their faith is an invalid text.
Exactly. Believing something despite proof is not faith. That's stupidity.
Well, believing something that can be proven to be false is utter stupidity.
Yeah.
Since the evidence proves without any question whatsoever, text of the Christian New Testament is unreliable. Therefore, faith in Christianity is foolish. That's just the bottom line here. The text of the Christian New Testament is so unreliable, so convoluted, so filled with errors and alterations, there is no way to solve the problem. And therefore, faith in what it says is stupid. It's not just that faith is required when proof is unavailable. In this case, proof is available.
Yeah.
That their faith is misguided. That it's in a text which cannot be trusted, which is untrustworthy. The Roman Catholic Church is about as untrustworthy as any institution in the history of humankind. In fact, God says it's the most oppressive and counterproductive institution in the history of humanity. That it would tread upon the whole earth, oppress the whole earth. But for those who say, well, I'm not part of that 1.5 billion that are Roman Catholics. I'm part of the 400 million that are Protestants, and, you know, we cling to Scripture only. Well, I'm here to tell you, God doesn't have a word Bible. He doesn't have a word Scripture. He did not inspire the Christian New Testament. There is no New Testament from his perspective.
And
what you have, is wholly and completely unreliable. Those are the facts. You know, you're entitled to your opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
Yeah.
And if you have to ignore the facts, if you have to reject the facts,
you're an idiot.
To promote your faith, you're an idiot.
Yeah, plain and simple.
Plain and simple. So don't blame me for a lack of faith until you have observed the evidence. In the introduction to his book, Comfort wrote, this book provides transcriptions of 69 of the earliest New Testament manuscripts. All of the manuscripts are dated from the early 2nd century to the beginning of the 4th, A.D. 100 to 300. We chose A.D. 300 as our terminus daquim because New Testament manuscript production changed radically after the persecution under Diocletian, A.D. 303 to 305, and especially after Constantine declared Christianity to be a legal religion in the empire. It changed radically.
radically.
Changed radically when applied to a manuscript production means that the manuscripts copied after 325 CE were so different than their predecessors, they could no longer be comparable. It would not take long for the alterations to blossom from tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands.
Now, you know, you talk about, you know, you're entitled to your own opinions, but not your own facts. You know, Philip Comfort is a perfect example of that. You've read his book, Encountering the Manuscript. His facts are excellent.
Mm-hmm.
His opinion on where those facts lead is idiotic.
Idiotic.
It's the complete opposite of what the facts show. His conclusion is that, oh, this is 100% reliable. The facts show that, no, you can't trust any of this.
Correct. Yeah, and the reason that his conclusions, opinions, let's call them, because they're not fact-based, are incongruous with the facts, is that Philip Comfort publishes through Christian publishers, and his books are purchased by Christian readers. And so if he were to say, well, you know, if you study the oldest manuscripts, you'll recognize that they're incongruous with the Nestle Allen, the Textus Receptus, and therefore this shows that the text just is not reliable. How many Christians do you think are going to buy that book?
Nobody.
But that's what the evidence is.
If you have a handful that buy it, throw it away after reading 10 sentences, and then tell everyone else not to read it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So let's consider a visual example. If you were to dive into a swamp and grab a bucket full of alligator excrement, then dissect what you had found, studying the evidence by amplifying the specimens individually and collectively under a microscope, sharing every nuance that could be derived from a close and careful evaluation of this collection. The fact remains that all you would be contemplating would be a chaotic arrangement of reptilian discharge that has been rotting away in a swamp. Nothing will ever change that, no matter how accurate or complete your rendition of the information conveyed therein becomes. It makes no difference how one slices, analyzes, polishes, or rearranges this product of decay. Swamps not only tend to breed bacteria, they are home to some of the world's most venomous and deadly reptiles, and are not safe for human habitation, such is the case with the manuscripts of the Greek text of the Christian New Testament. Any attempt to accurately translate what remains is akin to evaluating decomposing organic material plucked from a swamp. As crude as this may sound, even shocking, it accurately depicts the condition of the Christian scriptures. And as we will discover in due time, Yahweh uses the same metaphor to depict this same errant testimony. I think that's a good stopping point, and we will pick this up again next week. There's a lot still to learn. And I think if we can make people aware, and we know that newbies are far more prone to listen than they are to read, that their faith is in reptilian discharge analyzed and dissected from a swamp, that there is no credibility to the Christian New Testament. And as we'll find, there is no New Testament. Yahweh does not have an Old Testament and a New Testament, and he has not yet renewed his covenant, and when he renews it, by his own admission, it's going to be renewed on the basis of a full integration of the Torah into our lives, not a replacement of it. And it's going to be renewed with Yisrael Yahudim,
Yeah.
Not with a Gentile church. Oops.
Oops.
And as we have learned, and those who want to verify it should read Questioning Paul, 666 years exactly before Paul would pen his first letter, wrote a prophecy in Chabaouk about this fellow named Shaul, which was Paul's given name, and detailed every aspect of what he would do, calling him the plague of death. And it isn't the only place that Paul is mentioned. There are hundreds of places where Yahweh denounces Paul. Oh, as I said, I was trying to decide, do I turn to Zechariah, the first six chapters, which are really interesting, and I really want to and hope to be able to translate them and comment on them, or do I proceed with Yahshua? And I read the sixth chapter, and there was Paul right in the midst of Yahweh's denunciation of religion, leading to a rejection of the Torah. And immediately thereafter, Yahweh is lifting up what appears to be this standard from which we are conveying this information.
Amazing. Thrilling.
Yeah, it is thrilling. It is thrilling. We're in a most marvelous place in time. This is the best opportunity that we humans have ever had. I mean, I think it's better than Adam had. Yeah, I know Adam gallivanted and had long conversations and great picnics and celebrations with Yahweh. You know, Yahweh himself created all of the animal life that he had created before him, and you know, let Adam even choose the names for the critters. Yeah, that'd be marvelous. And Adam did have an Nesama, so he could think.
Mm-hmm.
But Adam did not have the knowledge that we have available to us. And you could say, well, you know, it was much easier for Noah because, you know, Noah got directions directly from God. Now, Noah was given instructions as to how to build an ark to save the life that God had created and the lives of his family. He listened to what God did and devoted himself to building that ark, but it wasn't even 1/1,000,000th of the information that's available to us that was available to him.
Consider Abraham. He just spoke to him for a few minutes. He said, then you come out of there, and then we'll go here, and then never talk to him until he got there.
You're right.
Boy, that's a little bit trusty there.
Yeah, you look at his conversations. You can go through in an hour's time and dissect every conversation that Yahweh had with Abraham. Maybe not an hour. Maybe it's 3 or 4 hours' time.
But still, you can do that much on a couple of
chapters. We can benefit from every discussion Yahweh had with every one of the prophets, every one of the forefathers, you know, Moses, everyone. We benefit from all of it.
We
gain
all.
From what he said.
We have to put a little effort into it.
We gain from what he said to Noah. We gain from his discussions with Abraham. We gain from his discussions with Jacob. We gain from his discussions later through Moshe and the Torah. And then we gain from everything
from
we can read through the prophets. Right. We can gain from his relationship with Dode. So we have the benefit of all of this and the ability to have access to older and more accurate texts than have
I can't think of
ever
any better time to live.
Yeah. Marvelous tools to help us understand the words and then the ability scientifically to understand the brilliance of the of it all. It's the best of all times to live. And it's right before Yahweh's return, where we're literally seeing
the
ultimate conflict between man and God. The reason I wanted to begin with Antifa, which means anti-fascist. They're anti-capitalist, anti-fascist. They're communists. The reason I wanted to begin there is because that is the ultimate religion of man. They have a religious zeal. They are the jihadists of communism. And they play a very significant role in the ultimate turn to anarchy in America. America is going to not become great again, as if America was ever great. It's all hard. And I think that just as the Bolsheviks caused Russia to fall apart and into anarchy, causing the deaths of tens of millions, and Mao's anarchists and communists did the same thing, leading to the deaths of tens of millions, and the same thing happened in Cambodia with Pol Pot, and the same thing happened in North Korea, that this is what you're witnessing with Antifa. The same religious zeal for the religion of man, socialist secular humanism. And it's going to lead to anarchy. And so we're at a time where where this contrast between the word of God and the word of man is so distinct. What a marvelous time to make a difference.
I want to say just one thing about, because there's a lot of discussion about, and also with some folks I talked to on the phone and email back and forth with about, there's the spoken word, like we're doing now, and then there's the written word, and then, of course, there's inspiration from Ruach Kodesh and things like that. It's by far, in my opinion, by far the written word is the most important. And the reason it came
beyond
to me,
beyond
compare to me, it's not even a debate. I don't devalue what we're doing and what you're doing here.
I do.
I think it's a great adjunct because I'm sitting here reading what you're reading. I mean, and I'm taking notes on that and all that. So it's like a study group on stuff that we're, you know, that's already written. Without the written word here, I'd just be listening to you and losing 80% of it anyway. You know, but because I'm looking at the same material, reading that, plus taking notes on the side and scribbles and stuff, and it's a great work. It's a great study tool. However, what hit me this week as I was doing some study for the other program is I was just starting with a section in Bar-Sheath, Genesis, and getting all this about all these children and what their promises were and what their things he's talking about that happened to them. And that's fine. And then all of a sudden, I'm over in Dabarim, and I'm doing what Moshe said as a follow-up to that. And then, for some reason, I was reading in Numbers, and so that had some value. And then I took in Numbers, it not only talks about each one of these individuals, but it talks about their sons and grandsons or their fathers. So for some reason, I said, well, I'm going to look up all the names of the fathers and the sons and see what those names mean, because we know all the names have a meaning. And it was tremendously revealing about the characteristics of the person in question. You know, if you're talking about Reuben, and then you look at his son was, and his son's son was, or his father was, and his son was, and it's just amazing. Now, if you didn't have all the written word, I couldn't spend 20 hours on that.
So, right. I'm with you on this. I mean, the only reason, and I'm reluctant to do this show, because I think that doing the show has played into the hands of the many people who are in social media, and they can listen in, and they get little nuggets here and there, and they
run with it. I understand,
right?
I understand.
And that world is really troubling. I mean, that's how, by the way, Antifa organizes their riots is social media, and it's an artificial world that is where people strive for the number of quote unquote friends, and they post is strives for people checking likes, how many likes a post has, and the problem with the spoken word is that it is so easily misconstrued. Lies and spoken lies are very powerful tools. And that's why all of the errors that have crept into the thinking of Fred, who is, you know, our new raging anti-Semite, it's all based on the videos where it's the spoken word. The only reason I do this is that I realize that very few people are going to be attracted, drawn into, even considered willing to investigate the books, you know, 7,000-8,000 pages of translation and commentary on Yahweh's word, unless they hear it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they hear it on a radio show,
hear
it on this program, or hear it because it's posted on a YouTube someplace, unless they hear it, they're not going to be ever consider the time it takes to analyze the written word. But, you know, Yahweh was known only one way, through his written word.
Mm-hmm.
And you might say, well, you know, the set-apart spirit. I mean, set-apart spirit isn't going to help you understand who Yahweh is unless you're observing Yahweh's testimony.
His word.
Right, his word.
You know, I will say, I'm a very auditory learner. And so there is that benefit to it. But it's a double-edged sword. The audible word, the spoken word, can much more easily be manipulated and changed and used to evoke emotion. You know, it can be used as it's a great tool for teaching, but it can also be abused more easily than the written word.
Correct. Oh, absolutely. And the detail, the dependability, the ability to be verified of the written word vastly exceeds the spoken word. And that's why Yahweh is made manifest to us today through his written word. And he used a language that accurately represents it. Hebrew. Now, you don't have to speak Hebrew to understand him in the language he chose, but you've got to realize that his revelation to us is exclusively in Hebrew, and that there are some profound aspects of Hebrew that just aren't existent in many other languages. Like you're an artist, Kirk, and you recognize that every one of the Hebrew letters tells a story. The letters that comprise the word define the words because they're graphic. And that in Hebrew, unlike English, verbs are not stuck in time. Just like Yahweh, they're infinite in time. And unlike English, verbs all have stems that establish a relationship between the subject and object based upon the action of the verb. And that unlike English, there's two conjugations, ongoing and completed.
Perfect and imperfect,
Yeah, perfect and the imperfect. And that the Hebrew moods almost exclusively convey volition, free will. What an absolutely marvelous language for an eternal being to express eternal truths. Especially about relationships that are the product of free will. That does not exist in English, does not exist in Latin, does not exist in Greek. He spoke Hebrew. And so if you want to understand him, you've got to take the time to appreciate what he said in the language that he spoke. Now, I've gotten to the point now where I think in Hebrew. I've spent enough time with it that now I think in Hebrew. So I read what God said, and I'm now translating what he said out of Hebrew into English, because I recognize that there's just not enough people in the world who think in Hebrew. And the Hebrew of Yahweh is quite different than the Hebrew of modern Israelis.
Modern speech, yeah. Modern speech, yeah, for the Hebrew people. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. Well, they're just as twisted as everybody else. I mean, they don't
Correct.
Think in those terms because they've been indoctrinated
yeah.
by their rabbis and their teachers and their culture.
Now, if I am correct, and I can't find any other possibility, that the standard that Yahweh was lifting up is our work here in this at this time, then it's specifically it has to come from a place very far away from Yisrael. It is something that, unlike his revelation to humankind, it took place over more than 1,000 years, and this came together, you know, in a decade, which is extraordinarily quickly. In fact, yada yada, within 5 years, the whole thing within a decade. And although it is being disseminated to the far ends of the earth by Yahweh, he's drawing attention to it. It's for people living in the Gentile nations. And when you think about it, although lots of Yehudim have come to know Yahweh as a result of Yada Yah and intro to God and observations and questioning Paul and the like, all of those Yehudim, without exception, have been those that are living in places like America, Canada, South America, Europe, or New Zealand or Australia. Yes. Faraway places. The land, the nations of the Goyim. Based upon what I know of the mindset of Israelis, the likelihood of an Israeli embracing Yada Yah in a land where Rabbi and Talmud reign supreme among those who are religious, and those who are not religious would never even consider the Word of God. It isn't their time, but it's Yehudim that are going to read it outside of Yisrael and are going to take it back with them when drawn into Yisrael that are going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very plausible.
Yeah.
I believe that's the way it will happen.
But it is to my knowledge, it is the only counter to Pauline Christianity and counter to this this myth that the Torah is no longer valid.
Well, if you can find one, I don't know where it is.
Yeah, and that's what God is attacking here. That's why he's lifting up the standard.
And the Christians can't, and Protestantism can't attack Catholicism because all they are is they got their own little deal going, but it's the same thing.
Right. But there is
he's not going to call either, so who are you kidding?
Right. And they're absolutely Pauline, and so they're part of the problem, and they're absolutely Torahless.
Yes.
It ain't them. So it's it was really an interesting read. Well, it was fun to do this with you. We'll continue it next week, and I'll maybe by that time I'll have more of Yada Yah 5 done. But I did send you a copy of 13. It's
thank you very much.
Still at the point where I can edit it, add to it, augment it, clarify it, whatever you think needs to be done to it.
All right. Look forward to it.
Yep, it was an interesting journey through Yirmiyah. Most of it's Yirmiyah 23. Is really unhappy with religion. You know, that's the place where he says, "You replace my name with the Lord," and it's where he is very specific on religion and why he hates it. And the consequence of it. And those who are religious are going to spend their eternity separated from God.